Jamie's parents are NIMBYs.
I started recording. You sure you want that on the record?
I'd tell them they were NIMBYs. We talked about it over his birthday weekend in Prague.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello, I'm John Elijah. This is Skylines, the Citymetric podcast. One of the tricks with this show is to try and keep the balance between, you know, quite big, heavy, intellectual, wonkish ideas and talking complete and utter nonsense.
And me!
Vaguely relates to a city. So yeah, here's Sarah Menavis joining me to talk about something that's been vexing me a little bit about you and your relationship to this very fine city in which we live, is that you don't like it very much, do you?
I really don't like it. I've always f***ing hated it. As a child, I came to the UK on a holiday, which was a bad family holiday, and half of it was spent in the English countryside driving around, but my parents would not let us go into Stonehenge because it cost too much money, so we like looked at it from the motorway from it.
I've literally done the exact same thing on the way back from a wedding. It was like 15 quid to get in the massive queue, whereas
we flew to England to look at the rock formation. Sorry, am I screaming now into this?
And you're getting so angry about this.
I can remember it so vividly because of how disappointing that trip was. Because my parents were like, we'll fly all the way to the UK. We'll drop all of that money. But the like extra like £50 it's going to cost to get the four of us in here, no thanks.
When I did my first US road trip in 2008 for the Obama-McCain election, we drove 7 hours out of our way to go to Buffalo, New York, so we could see Niagara Falls. And like I said, we were on the road for 7 hours. It was a stop that wasn't related to my campaign reporting. We got there and it was like $8 to park in the car park. And my friend Scott, who was driving me, was so enraged by that. He wanted to get straight back on the interstate. It's like, no, don't be an idiot. Just like, let's get... Anyway, there is a
but
very...
But that's what happens.
But there is a great view of Stonehenge from the side of the A303. Next to an ice cream stand, and you can kind of see it as the Druids intended on the horizon through a metal chain link fence.
Yeah. That's the thing, is it was like the Stonehenge prison yard experience. Like, it was not, why would we drive all the way there and fly all the way to that country to like just go and do that? Anyways, that was one half of the holiday, and that's the half I actually liked. We went to Windsor Castle, and that was fun.
But we've drifted.
I'm getting back to it.
You said you hated London as a child, and you're now talking about hating.
Again, now I'm getting back to it. The other half
Stonehenge
of the holiday,
and your parents.
The other half of the holiday was spent in London. The only thing I wanted to go see was, I was like, ooh, let's go to Wimbledon and look at the tennis courts, the world famous tennis courts. And literally the rest of it, I was like, this place is a shithole. There's black stuff in my nose.
You come like, from Dayton, Ohio.
Yes. Again, people seem to think that I mean that in comparison to the shithole I grew up in. But I think that this is a, like, especially a shithole because people pretend it's like the best thing that's ever happened, when in reality, it's just like a very wide shithole. And that's really how I feel. And even as like a 14-year-old on Facebook, on my iPod Touch or my sister's iPod Touch, I was like, oh, I don't like it here. It's so rainy and it's so dirty. There's shit in my nose. I hate it.
Okay, but like, let's...
I'm never going to come here again. And that it's like, what is it called? Smash frame?
Smash cut.
Crash. Yeah, whatever. That. To today, and I'm like, oh, here I am. I'm really happy to have my dog in like 1 square foot of space.
I mean, you probably shouldn't have like moved to the UK and then decided you wanted to work
actually,
in the media.
Yeah, that's actually what I think about every morning of my life.
Those are the wrong choices.
That's the shower thought but I have every day, as a tear rolls down my face, but it's masked by the rest of the shower. Why?
The tear is black because of the air pollution.
Yes, exactly. From
but
the
why?
Pollution.
Okay, as long-term listeners will know, I grew up in the suburbs.
Romford, right?
Represent. And... I found out the other day that my borough voted 70% leave. I knew it was pro-leave, but I didn't realise it's like way, way pro-leave. Like, it's far more than any of the other pro-leave boroughs in London. I think when you grow up on the fringes of a city, you tend to sort of, like, the city is where all the action is happening. Mm. So I think part of why I was always sort of interested in, like, London as a sort of idea is it kind of just represented, you know, real life over there. It's, you know, I'm in this boring place, but at the end of this train line, everything is happening. So I think that does kind of give you a slightly dewy-eyed impression of a city in a way, like if you grew up outside it altogether, maybe you don't get that.
I grew up on the edge. Like, my town was a suburb.
There was a suburb of Dayton, Ohio. Yes, okay. It wasn't a suburb of, like, a real place.
It was a shithole. However, my mom grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, and I loved Chicago, and I loved going there, and I loved going down, like, Michigan Avenue and Lakeview Drive and looking out and all the buildings, and ooh, it's so exciting. Ooh, there's Saks Fifth Avenue here. Like, I enjoyed that. I enjoyed Seattle as a child. I'm not anti-city, but I am very anti-London, and I think it's really, really gross. And then you can get into all the socioeconomic issues with London. And just as people on our desk, like four people on our desk alone, live in Peckham, and we're laughing at the Financial Times' piece about gentrification in Peckham. Were you not here
two.
For this?
No. Indra, the New Statesman online sub-editor Indra Warnes, did write a very good piece, which was her diary of being a passenger on Thameslink.
That was very good. I felt like that was insightful.
It was.
I really felt like my eyes were open to how bad it is. Because I complain about, like, everybody's going to give me shit for this. I live in Notting Hill. Oh, horrible, whatever. I'm American. Let me live. I have to wait for the Circle line at Notting Hill Gate, which only comes at best every 10 minutes. And even that feels like a burden I have to bear every Monday to Friday. However, the Croydon thing made me think, you know what, it's not so bad. And I get to see Seamus Milne most days, so that's always fun.
I saw Seamus Milne at the opera the other week.
Are you joking?
No.
When were you at the opera?
My other half likes opera.
I like opera.
I tolerated opera.
What opera were you at with Seamus Milne?
I should probably explain for anyone who isn't, like, obsessed with British politics that Seamus Milne is the communications director for Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, and he's still officially a Guardian staffer on leave, but has has certain opinions on foreign policy.
Yes, he's the architect of, yes, all these things. Although one thing I will say is, like, I read Captain Corelli's Mandolin because Jamie's mom gave it to me for Christmas, and I hated it, and I thought it was, like, a cartoonish representation.
You're just like this sort of burning ball of hatred for...
Well, like, it's a very cartoonish representation of not only Greek people but also Italians. And essentially, are you getting upset for my shouting or upset for how long I'm talking about?
No, I'm just slightly adjusting the volume.
But I read Captain Crowley's Mandolin, and I was really upset by its representation of Greek people. So I was, like, googling, like, oh, like, Captain Crowley Mandolin public reaction Greece or whatever, and the one person who'd written a huge thing about how Greek people hate that book is Seamus Milne.
Oh, well, there you go.
Which I think is very funny. I thought that was a funny Easter egg that I found in his, like, Guardian backlog of, like, actually the US deserved 9/11 pieces.
Okay, circling back to the topic in hand, you live in a picture book bit of London.
Yeah.
You live in a place where there's a Richard Curtis film.
Yes.
And you're complaining about it.
I mean, and I know that this is my own doing, but it is very expensive around there. Coffees are very expensive there.
Yeah,
ho,
I'm not
ho.
Surprised.
Yeah, exactly. It's... They have very good charity shops if you are a woman who likes designer clothes but likes spending £7 on literally anything.
Is it possible that, you know, you are in fact a snob who has decided you can only live in one of the nicest bits of London and then discovered that it's still, you know, fundamentally part of a big city and everything's just overpriced? And, like, maybe you would have been happier if you'd just been a bit more comfortable living in a place with some poor people.
Oh my God, I live in a bit of London. I actually, and this is a misconception about Notting Hill, is I live, like, right near Grenfell. And, like, it is actually relatively diverse. And my bit is the bit right when it starts to not be super posh.
I have been to your house.
Yes, but it is near there. There are, like, it's actually very diverse. But it's not... It is! Literally, Jamie's uncle, who is not white, he was like, I grew up around there and it's way more diverse than people think and blah, 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 blah. His parents, I think, were, like, Windrush generation.
Yeah, I mean, Kensington has always been a lot more mixed than people give it credit for, because North Kensington is a very
working class area. Yeah, exactly.
And also, like, yeah, once upon a time, Notting Hill was...
As the presence
of the carnival would suggest, Notting Hill was an area that a lot of the Windrush generation of Caribbean immigrants moved to. Nonetheless, I've been to your house and it doesn't feel like that. It does feel like...
I'm not trying to say it's not posh.
You live very near the Portobello Road, which is this kind of posh
market.
But
the shit end of it.
Okay.
There is a shit end of it.
Maybe
not
you'd be happier in Peckham.
So
have you been to Peckham?
I actually haven't been to Peckham, but I've read a very interesting piece in the Financial Times today about it and all of its graveyards.
Nunhead Cemetery is a hell of a...
Well, the thing is, I think that my issue is a combination of two things, which is, one, growing up in not a posh family, but living in a posh area. But so I saw all the big houses, I saw all of the, like, really nice things, but I couldn't afford, you know, like, we weren't... anyways, I don't need to get into my class background because that's just like its own can of worms. But it was like aspirational. It's like one day, American dream, I can have the big house with a big garden and all that bullshit. And it was very pretty and stuff. And that's mixed with the fact that I was like, I think like the aspirational side, as well as the fact that I was exposed to it, makes me like leafy areas that are posh because I can pretend I'm posh.
But it does mean like sometimes you're missing out on...
Yes, I think I am missing out. I think there are things I could be getting out of London. However, I would rather live in different cities that weren't posh. Like Glasgow, I would argue, is even better in a lot of ways.
Glasgow, I mean, I've only been there for like once for 6 hours, but I loved it. I just instantly loved the place.
No, you were there when I told you to come to Edinburgh to see me. And you were like, I've been to Edinburgh 10 times. Yeah, I used to go there
and
fly.
I remember, now you say this, I remember, I mean, firstly, this was before we'd ever met, not on the
internet.
That's
why I thought it'd be fun. Like,
I've got one night in Glasgow, I'm not going to get on the train
and that's what you said. And I was like, okay, fine.
That's not the point of this story. I couldn't live in, like, Glasgow's great, but I couldn't live there because you wouldn't think the weather would be that much worse than London, but somehow
it is
in
actually
Scotland.
Very bad.
Yeah.
Please mind the gap between the train and the platform.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
So I am here once again in the centre of the city's very glamorous London Bridge offices with Head of Policy, Paul Swinney. Hello, Paul.
Hello, John. How are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you this morning?
Yeah, I'm all right.
We're recording this in early March, so we're going to pretend that, like, you know, we're just going to ignore Brexit because, like, whatever we say now, it might be overtaken by events. Although knowing the way things have been going recently, it probably won't be. But anyway, we're going to keep that whole side of the conversation vague. But we are going to talk about a vaguely related issue of exports. You guys talk a lot about sort of exports from cities, don't you? And in like your reports, you kind of have a sort of standard number of, like, you know, percentage of jobs working in sort of export industries and so on. But we don't really tend to think of, like, you know, exports as being a sort of city level thing. We tend to think of them as being a national thing, like a thing you do across the national frontiers. So we're going to get into why you think this is important, but let's start with the boring definitional question. What do you mean by an export in this context?
So when we talk about exporters within a city, we're talking about any business that sells beyond its local market. So traditionally, when we think about exports, we think, like you say, on a country basis, and so that means an export from one country to another country. But in this space, it's actually about an export from a city to its wider region or a city to the rest of the country, as well as obviously elsewhere in the world. And that's quite interesting because, you know, the location decisions of these types of businesses are very different to the other group of businesses that we look at, which are local services. So there'll be hairdressers, shops, cafes and those sorts of things. You know, those local service businesses are there purely because there's loads of people to sell to or there's a market to sell to. Whereas exporting businesses, you know, in principle, because they sell to loads of different markets, they could locate anywhere in theory. When cities are trying to attract in businesses, it's actually these exporting type businesses are trying to attract in rather than sort of the whole gamut of businesses that you get. And that's why, you know, it's interesting to understand how these businesses perform and where they decide to locate, because they're the ones that drive on local economies.
So which way does the causality run here? If you look at a city economy with a large proportion of export businesses in it, meaning they're selling to, you know, other cities rather than other countries, is that, like, important because, like, you need those businesses to have a healthy city economy? Or is it important because it's, you know, it's a measure of the fact you do have a healthy city economy, because if you didn't, then the businesses wouldn't be there?
They are the drivers of city economies. And there are a couple of reasons for that. The first one is that if you look at productivity, which we're all very much interested in at the moment, exporting businesses tend to be more productive. What does that mean for people? Higher wages, more money in people's pockets. But also what's interesting is if you look at over the last 20, 30 years, you can see that they're the ones that push on productivity growth as well. So how can we sort of see that in real life? Well, if you think about, say, a local service business like a yoga instructor or an exercise instructor, you know, in 2019, they may well be playing music now through their iPhone rather than playing it through a ghetto blaster, but they're still only teaching a room full of people. You know, the ability to see large productivity gains in those types of jobs is limited. It's the same for waiters and waitresses or people pulling pints or hairdressers, for example. You just don't see huge increases in productivity.
It's you don't really want your hairdresser to get twice as fast necessarily, do you? You kind of want to,
They're physically limited by you know, their two hands and how long it takes to cut a head of hair. Whereas, you know, exporting businesses, because they're selling in many different markets and they can scale their businesses and they can absorb new innovations, actually, they're always finding new and better ways of doing things. And indeed, you know, that's the main reason why we see differences across the country in terms of how well cities perform. Exporters of the Greater South East are the types of businesses that cities in the Greater South East have been able to attract in, have been these higher skilled element of exporters. Whereas further north, you know, they've attracted in exporting businesses. They have a tradable base that trades nationally, internationally, which is great. But the types of activity that they do tends to be lower skilled, low productivity, and that has implications in terms of wages, prosperity, benefit dependency, all these different things.
Okay, can we drill down into that a little bit? You're talking about these two different types of export businesses, high skilled and low skilled. Can you give me a couple of examples of each and kind of give a sense of like why they locate in the places they do?
Definitely. So the way I always like to illustrate this is not even to think about different businesses, but to think about the same business. And I've got two examples that come from or relate to my home city of Sunderland. So the first one is Barclays Bank. Barclays Bank has a big presence in Canary Wharf, where it does all of its investment banking activity, all that high value stuff. Some people might disagree with it being high value, but it, you know, it tends to be more productive as long as it's sort of, you know, doing things that are legal, etc. Not to say that Barclays has ever done anything illegal.
A friend of mine works for Barclays Bank. I don't think he's very high value. I'm just chucking this out there because he used to listen to this podcast just in case.
Well, he can feed back and he can tell us what goes on within Canary Wharf Towers. But in general, the type of activity that's going on there is high value. It's high skill. You know, it pays high wages. But not all of Barclays' activities go on within their base within Canary Wharf. Actually, the back office stuff occurs within Sunderland. So there's a former enterprise zone up in Sunderland, and they've got a big Barclays call centre and does all of its back office functions. Now, why does that happen? Why does even the same business split out its activities across these two locations? Well, Canary Wharf offers Barclays lots of high-skilled workers and a network of other investment banks that they can trade with, share ideas with, and compete against too. And, you know, Barclays will pay premium to get access to those benefits. You know, so despite the rent that you have to pay within Canary Wharf, Barclays is sitting its investment banking activities within Canary Wharf rather than Doxford Park in Sunderland. But the back office stuff, you know, the more routinised stuff, the stuff that doesn't require knowledge, doesn't require, or quite routinises activities, Barclays would never put that sort of stuff in Canary Wharf because it's dead expensive to be located there. And that type of activity doesn't get any benefit from being based there. Instead, what they're looking for that part of the business is lots of cheap land and lots of probably lower skilled, perhaps cheaper workers as well. Now, Sunderland doesn't offer the benefits of Canary Wharf, but it does offer the benefits of cheap land and cheaper workers. And that's why it's then able to attract in this type of activity. So it will always out-compete London for a call centre. Actually, it will probably always out-compete Southend for a call centre as well, because London Southend is fairly expensive. But it would never out-compete London for an investment bank because of the benefits that London is able to offer. We say the same thing for Nissan. You know, the car plant in Sunderland employs 7,000 workers, hugely important for the economy, but actually it's mainly a components assembly factory. You know, there's not much what we would call value add going on within there.
You mean there's not like the design work going
precisely
on there, the engineering?
Exactly. So engineering occurs in Cranfield in Oxfordshire, design occurs in Paddington in London, you know, for the reasons that we set out before. So, you know, even looking within two businesses, we can see they're splitting out their activities because of the different benefits that different places offer. And crucially, this then has a huge impact on how successful different economies are across the country.
I like the way that your low-skilled business is Barclays Bank there. Like, no, it's a low-skilled bit of Barclays Bank. I mean, it's some nice shade, as they would say, on the internet. So can a city prosper without having that many exporting businesses? Like, is it possible to kind of prosper just by, like, selling to yourself? Is there a size of city in which that becomes possible?
Well, this is the great debate about openness and trade, or should you have closed economies? And I think there's lots of work on a country level which shows that trade is a good thing, being open is a good thing. And indeed, you know, President Trump's trade tariffs obviously have caused all sorts of consternation amongst economists that this will be a bad thing, closing trade down rather than opening it up. If you're just selling to yourself, you know, it's sort of circular, you're not really bringing any sort of new money in the economy, you're not finding new ways of innovating and driving on productivity. So it would be very difficult, I think, to see increasing standards of living if you were very closed. Now, that is very interesting in the context of what is being called the Preston model. And this is this idea that particularly, I think, is taking hold within certain parts of the Labour Party. And Preston is called that because Preston are doing it. Which is the public sector is only going to trade with local bodies. It's only going to do local procurement. Now, where exactly the boundary is in that, it's not clear. But effectively what they're saying is that we're no longer going to give contracts to people in Birmingham or companies in London or companies in Edinburgh. Instead, what we're going to do is only spend our money in the local economy to support, you know, support their businesses, which in principle sounds great. You know, well, yeah, buy local, excellent. And we have things like the Bristol Pound and stuff like that that tries to encourage consumers to buy locally too. The reality of that, though, is that it's very similar to Trump's trade tariffs in that you're putting up barriers and you're saying, we're only going to trade with these companies. We're going to look after our own first. And that has all sorts of potential negative implications that you're not trading with the world. You're a closed economy, and that could actually limit prosperity, even though sort of the idea is, oh, no, it'll boost local businesses.
I'm going to stop you there just because I did want to let you do a whole podcast when you made this argument. I'm sure you will do it again in the future. So we'll leave it till next time. Paul, thank you very much.
Okay, so I feel we're drifting from our core topic, but we haven't really arrived at the core topic of like explaining what it is you don't like about. You're going to tell me what you don't like, and I'm going to argue with you and tell you why it's in fact brilliant. Why don't you like London?
So, how about I start with what I do like about London? Okay. I like that it's very diverse. I like that you have lots of different types of food and you have lots of different types of things and jobs. However, I think that that's also part of the problem with London. Not the problem with London, the problem with the UK, which is that like, the one thing like is that London has all these things and you almost are forced to be here if you want to be exposed to anyone who isn't like a white, usually generationally British person, other than like small pockets.
So I don't think that's entirely fair in that most of the big cities are a lot more diverse than you're suggesting. Like one of the most diverse cities in Britain is actually Birmingham. Like if you
well,
walk
like
around,
Birmingham
is very visibly
Birmingham
diverse.
Is more diverse. However, I do think London is its like own thing in a lot of ways.
But like we often
a sixth of the country lives here, and that's obviously f***ed up. That shouldn't be a thing, and that is your own doing in this country. And anyways, but that's not why I dislike London. That's why I like it, because it's got all that stuff.
For the record, London's always been vastly bigger than the other British. Like in the 16th century, London was like 10 times bigger than the second
city. Yeah, but I think that they should have done a better job of figuring that out.
Distribution. I agree with you. I've written on multiple occasions we should move the capital and devolve power.
Think we should move the capital?
I mean, I can think that safely because I know they're not going to do it. But yes, I think it would be the correct policy choice. I don't think you do
to
it.
To where?
I'd put it in Manchester.
Why?
It's roughly the middle of the country geographically. You're near a lot of people because Manchester's in the middle of that cluster of northern cities.
Yeah.
So it gives you an entirely different view of British history and what Britain means because it was the centre of the Industrial Revolution. London would remain the financial and, you know, tourism capital and cultural probably. You could put political power in Manchester and take economic power with it to a certain extent, and then you kind of have like London is New York and Manchester
and,
is Washington,
DC, blah, blah.
And I don't think the London economy would skip a beat. I think you couldn't just press a button and do it. You would need to grandfather it in over probably about 20 years and say, you know, by 2040 the capital will be in Manchester. So because like, if you just try
is
to
that
move,
gonna be your platform when you join the Lib Dems?
Shut up. I would like to make very clear at this juncture that I'm, with apologies to our Lib Dem listener, I am not one of you. I'm never going to be. But like if you just tried to do it overnight, you would lose a lot of the manpower of the government, like not the MPs, but like, you know, the top civil servants and so on. Because people can't just up sticks because they have kids in school or elderly parents or whatever it is. But if you do it over a generation, it becomes possible to make those kind of plans and people can either move or they can switch careers and you don't lose the institutional memory. And I just think there are very few buttons a government can press that would magically sort of take a chunk of economic activity in London and put it somewhere else in the country. But
other than itself.
Is one of them. Yeah, basically. And also,
the
like,
true
if you look
power at, lied within.
If you look at infrastructure planning, projects in London are more likely to get approved because, like, at the most basic level, I think civil servants look at this and they'll be like, yep, I can see why we need Crossrail. Whereas if it's like, should we have a tram system in Leeds? You've got these guys making a decision in Whitehall, which is crazy in itself, but they're like, well, they can see the counter arguments much more easily. So I think it would also kind of just reframe how the government sees the rest of the country. Because you're right about that part. We are too over-centralized.
Yeah. I do think, like, I think as Finn Darby on Twitter made a joke about ages ago, it was like when Mary Black or one of the SNP MPs was like, how does Glasgow have fewer MPs than London or something like that? And he was like, why does the great, like, ancient kingdom of Fife have fewer MPs? Like, it's just like nobody lives there compared to how many people live in London. So I think, like, that's annoying, but I do think that, like,
if you ever really want to wind up a Scottish nationalist, do point out that London has twice the population of Scotland, and then
very upset.
They don't like maths sometimes, but that's a whole different thing. But okay, so, like,
that's
what, but why do you not, why do you no, that was actually the closest we've come this episode to some actual
it is
content.
A fucking tangent.
But why it's do you why personally like not like London?
So I think, like, it has a lot to do with the geography of it, as well as the economics. I like that it's very spread out, and I don't really mind that, but I do also think it, like, costs a lot of money, and the wealth disparity is really weird, and, like, it's, like, so oppressive, and there's, like, an attitude here that you don't get in other parts of the UK where everybody is, like, grumpy and mean, and, like, I don't know, you walk around and it feels like shit, and it feels stressful, and it's ugly most of the time, and, like, I know that that's, like, get over it, like, sorry it's not pretty, blah blah blah, but like I feel like I have to live here, but I don't necessarily have to, and so I'm allowed to not like that about this.
I think, I mean, okay, I'm going to argue with a couple of things here. I think huge chunks of London are very pretty.
Yes, but it's the fact that it's like, it's so big, and it's just like you're inevitably going to pass by like horrible shits like every single day.
I mean, wherever you go, there will also be terrible stuff as well.
Yes, but I think like in London, it's
but I sort of prefer
terrible.
That to the Parisian model, where you've got this absolutely incredible, beautiful centre, and then they've just pushed all the crappy bits to the suburbs.
Well, yeah,
and
like that's
never seen
in its own
them.
Way. But I do think I like if I was living there, I'd be like, yeah, I prefer that. But that's obviously like a very privileged thing.
And because, as we discussed earlier, it's because you hate poor people.
I don't hate poor people. I
you
literally
just, okay,
grew
you
up,
just don't want to see them.
I grew up very, like, not well off, and I had, like, family, and, like, you know, I was in the, like, U.S. during, like, the recession. Like, I know people whose parents were, like, very badly unemployed and, like, already had working class jobs and then were laid off from working class jobs. Like, I'm not, like, pretentious in that way, but I also think I did grow up in a very aesthetically pleasing environment, and I probably become accustomed to being in a very aesthetically pleasing environment. I grew up, like, around loads of trees and green space. And there is a thing, like, if you've read the book Happy City, it's not about how much green space there is, it's about the regularity of green space you're exposed to. And in London, you get these huge chunks of green space, which is great, but the regularity is not as much as I passed by Hyde Park.
I mean, you cross central London, so that's specifically that. But, like, London is quite green compared to... I mean, again, I'm thinking of Paris here.
Yes, but we're not talking about... Paris. Yeah, but it's
saying,
okay.
Like,
London has more
big
than
city,
Paris.
As big cities go, like
London
has
more
green space
than Doha. Like,
it has more green space than New York or Chicago.
Yes, but I'm not saying that New York. And also, Chicago is like on a huge lake that's like a freshwater lake, which is very beautiful. And Chicago, you don't walk around and blow your nose at the end of the day and have black shit in it.
See, I never get that.
Yeah, but that does happen in London. I remember that even as a kid.
No, I mean, I've been told this, but it's like, am I not
we've
getting it?
We've talked about
some...
this on this podcast. I swear to God we've talked about this, because like, you were like, oh, it doesn't happen. But it literally happens to like most people.
But this is, I'm wondering
maybe
if
you
like,
just have like no
am I
metabolizing
it or
yeah,
something?
Probably. Probably because you were like immersed in it as a baby.
I definitely have nostril hairs. I'm a man who's nearly 40. It's really upsetting. The extent
but like,
of
genuinely,
my nostril hair.
Because your nostril hairs should be catching it. You probably have very weak nostril hairs.
I have kind of consolidated most of my hair onto the top of my head, to be honest.
Which is good, again, for a man nearing 40.
Yeah. Okay, we should be wrapping up, so we can do a quick
but anyways, I think like...
Non-skincare bit.
London... I think London is incredibly expensive. It's incredibly exclusive. I think that to be able to enjoy a lot of things in London, you need to have a certain amount of income. And I think that is problematic. And I think that it, like, because of that attitude and, like, the quote-unquote rat race. I think that you end up, just because of the way the city functions and so many people in the city function, you end up feeling like shit if you're part of that machine.
I think there are a couple of things here. I think that's true, but I think that's a problem with the rat race rather than the problem with... I think London is the location of, not the symbol of that. The other thing is, you have chosen to live in West London, which, as everyone knows, is West London is worse London.
I kind of prefer living there, though, because I like being able to, like, hide away at the weekend, and I can just...
I mean,
take my dog to the park.
But the reason you can hide away there is because no one else who you are likely to know will ever make the choice of living in West London, because it's terrible.
I know someone who lives very near me in West London, who works at the Eye, and we see each other and we go have lunch.
It's dreadful, though. Why would someone live in West London? It's just like West London.
I think, like, having a dog, I'd like to let everybody know that I have a dog. And that also everyone knows part of our decision.
Dog, Sarah.
Just Stephen didn't know that I have a dog Instagram. He was like, oh, Sarah, I like being friends with you and I like seeing pictures on Instagram of your dog because it's you with the dog. You're not one of these people that runs an Instagram for your dog. And I was like, unfortunately, you are not following Hey There, It's Martha on Instagram. And I do run an Instagram for my dog, and she has over 100 followers, and I'm very proud of her. And she looks very cute lately.
I follow that account, and I regret it. But anyway.
You don't regret it. She's cute.
It's just like...
She's so cute. Follow her at Hey There, It's Martha. And she's a little black cockapoo, and she's going to be 9 months old, and probably by the time this is out.
That's not many followers your dog has, but that's not...
I don't have... I'm not trying to get her into
she's
influencer
not
status.
Get,
she's I'm just
not
going to
get,
like,
any brand deals.
Yeah, no, but I don't need her to have a brand deal. The brand deal is in my heart.
Did you literally just... No, never mind.
Yeah, it is.
But
she's cute.
But my point is that, like...
She likes peanut butter.
West London is more and expensive, socks. And it's more rat racy, and it is more full of terrible people.
Yes, but I think that my issue is not, like... It's more about, like, not the day-to-day... Because, like, when I lived in Edinburgh, it was expensive. And, like, obviously London's own stratosphere. But, like, in terms of, like, day-to-day costs, it's not that much. Like, I still, like, I don't really go out to eat... I pack my lunch most days. You know, I do, like, a big grocery order from Tesco, and I make, like, bean curries. Like, I still can live cheaply in that way. But it's the fact that it's, like, the rent and the tube and the bills. And, like,
the
I want to go out for dinner.
One, then the rent would be a lot cheaper if you lived in, like, a real bit of London.
I don't think my rent is actually extortionate for where I live. And I think that's the secret to where I live, is people probably think I pay, like, much, much more monthly.
I'm just saying, I think you should consider moving to Peckham.
I'm not joking. I know you wanted to probably end on that note, but I am like, oh, maybe I should live somewhere in either, like, really north or really south London near a bunch of parks, and then Martha the dog can, like, play in a graveyard.
Well, there you go. Write and tell Sarah where she needs to live.
Yeah, actually do that. Tweet me. Tell me where you think I should live if I like grass and things like that.
Do you have any idea how difficult it is getting out of a podcast review? Because every time I start coming to conclusions, you just start yelling into the microphone.
Well,
again.
It's Friday and I'm enjoying just... putting my brain on ice, man. Just have it sitting back with my friend and boss, John Elledge.
Don't follow the dog. It's really
boring.
Follow
the dog. It is boring, but in a nice way. She's very cute and she got a haircut. You're trying to turn me off, aren't you?
You've been listening to Skylines, the podcast from City Metric, the New Statesman City site. It was presented and recorded by me, John Elledge, and produced by Nick Hilton. You can find Skylines every 2 weeks on iTunes, Acast, or whatever other app you use to get your podcast. And while you're there, why not leave us a nice review to tell other people we're here? It really helps people discover the show, and I'm a megalomaniac, so the more people I can get listening to this, the better, really. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.